Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
China is slowing down. After a quarter century of annual growth rates of as much as 10%, analysts say the Chinese government's estimates of 7% for this year are inflated, and Shanghai stock markets have tumbled more than 30% in 2015, despite bold measures to stabilize them. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The downturn in China has played a role in the recent volatility of stock markets in the U.S. and elsewhere, leaving many investors wondering about the extent to which China's problems will become the world's. We wanted to get a sense for what those problems are, what caused them, and how long they might last. So we've invited the former White House coordinator for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation to join us with some perspective. Matthew P. Goodman is William E. Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can find his work at csis.org. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
All right. I want to start at the beginning, or the relative beginning. Tell us some of the reasons China had such a long run of economic expansion.
Well, of course, China's growth story over the last three or four decades has been really nothing short of miraculous. They were a very poor agricultural-based economy up through the 1970s. And in the late 70s, the leader at the time, the effective leader, Deng Xiaoping, announced a series of market opening and reform measures that launched an expansion of their economy that was really the first time in history that there's been tremendous growth from a low base, but really extraordinarily sustained over 30 years. They've built a strong industrial base. They've moved a lot of people into the cities, and they brought about 600 million of those formerly agriculturally focused people into the middle class, which is really that is unprecedented in history to bring such a large group into this sort of middle class state. And so it is truly a miraculous story.
That massive expansion of the middle class is by all accounts a good thing for the millions of families who've risen into it. But a middle class society can't be one that also offers rock bottom labor costs.
That's right. Well, that's the sort of trap they're in. They built this base or this this record in the past on cheap labor, on strong investment, on exports, on one objective, which was growth. Everybody wanted to get rich. And all of those things are gone now. Labor is not cheap. They can't keep investing. They've overinvested. They export capability has also been constrained by the lack of growth in a lot of their export markets. And they don't have a single objective. They're not just looking for growth at all costs now. They are trying to protect the environment. They're trying to clean up government. They're trying to do a lot of things that middle-class people want beyond, they still want to get richer, of course, but they also want to achieve these other objectives. And that makes it much harder to manage an economy when you've got all those objectives.
Is there a move to move China to a more automated system of manufacturing, more robots, as has happened in the U.S., where we're still doing a lot of manufacturing, we just don't have a lot of people employed in the sector?
Yes, there is that move everywhere. I think the challenge for China is that their growth record was very much based on a low value-added, labor-intensive style of production. So, famously, as we all know, we get most of our Christmas toys from China. China's been good at making, as a colleague of mine once said, if you want a toy airplane, you get it from China. If you want a real airplane, you get it from Boeing. They haven't yet made that leap from the low-value production to this sort of really technology-intensive, high value-added production. And that's very difficult for any economy to do. And that's what China really is fundamentally facing, is how to get higher in that value chain and be more innovative, more technology focused. And they're accomplishing it in some areas, but as a sort of macroeconomic phenomenon, they haven't yet achieved that.
Matthew, when Deng Xiaoping opened the markets and catalyzed this period of, as you call it, miraculous growth, how much of that growth was tied directly to government funding and government-provided infrastructure, and how much was the product of private investment and entrepreneurship?
Well, the government has played a central role and continues to in the economy in China. At the beginning, most business activity was done by the state sector, and that was really the foundation of their growth. What's happened is a lot of these state sectors have become very large, inefficient, and now they're investing in things that can't be sustained, massive amounts of production of things that people don't need anymore, a lot of steel and other sort of hard things. And meanwhile, there has been a move to, I mentioned, market-based reform. Deng Xiaoping did encourage or allow the development of a private sector, and over time, that has grown quite formidable. So actually now China has a number of very successful companies. A lot of the brands have not yet reached our shores, but I think some of your listeners would have heard of Alibaba or Haier, which is a company that makes small refrigerators, among other things. And so I know in college dorms, you sometimes see those. Those brands haven't yet hit our shores, but those are made by private companies. And that side of the economy has been expanding significantly. But the state still, these state-owned enterprises continue to play a very central role, and particularly when it comes to important kind of strategic industries, you'll find the state more heavily involved.
If Chinese manufacturing slows down or simply goes through like a right-sizing sort of treatment, what is the impact on global commodities markets for the raw materials that go into factory-made goods?
Well, we're already seeing that impact as they have shifted from this investment-intensive, sort of heavy industry-based, infrastructure-based model of growth. They have had less need for those commodities. They were importing they still import a lot, but a lot less now of oil and timber and iron ore, lots of materials they needed to feed this investment-led growth. And that has already been slowing down the last couple of years. And countries from the Middle East to Australia, which sells a lot of iron ore in China, have been feeling the pinch of that. And, that's an inevitable part of this transition that they're trying to make from an investment-led growth model to one that is based more on domestic consumer spending, services, and sort of softer things. And that's a tough transition, but it's going to have one of the prices is going to be that if you're selling raw commodities into China, you're not going to sell as much as you did during that high growth period.
The reports that I've seen indicate that domestic consumption, at least for now, continues unabated. Is that accurate as far as you've seen?
Well, consumption overall in China has been a lot lower as a percent of their economy than in the U.S. In the U.S., it's about two-thirds of our economic activity comes from consumption. Now, we're kind of at the high end because we're good consumers. China's more in about a third to maybe 40% of their economy at the peak, and they need to get that up, and they know that. So in that sort of macro sense, they're still under-consuming and over-saving. But in the sense that I think you're talking about, this market disruption has not yet fed through to really constraining consumption. There's still a lot of these middle-class people in China who, of course, want their refrigerators and cars and holidays and other things that they want to spend money on. And that has been, relatively speaking, not as impacted yet because this is a relatively recent market break and not a lot of those people in the middle class were exposed to the stock market, although, a significant number were. So it's going to pinch. But for now, it hasn't shown up in the sort of macro data.
Okay, let's talk about the Chinese stock market. The recent declines in values have been hard to ignore, but how does the size and the value of the market in Shanghai compare with stock indexes in the rest of the world?
Well, it's still much smaller. They didn't have a stock market at all until 1990, plus or minus. I actually visited it when I was a U.S. Treasury official, and it was still housed in an old hotel built in the 1920s or 30s in the dining room. I remember that clearly. And it's grown much beyond that now, and they have their own fancy building and everything in Shanghai. But But it's still a much smaller market based on capitalization and size of activity and trading than New York or London. But it's been growing significantly, and a lot of people have been moving into the market in a way that, you know, had been something unfamiliar to them, to individual investors, until a few years ago. And now they're all kind of learning about ups and downs in the marketplace.
But most of the money sunk into the Shanghai market is Chinese money, right?
That's right. China has not generally allowed foreign investment into China. There are some exceptions. There's some windows for qualified institutional investors. But for the most part, China has kept its markets closed to outside investment. And that's because they want to maintain stability, and there are other implications of opening up your capital accounts, which are, lead to greater instability in some ways. And so most of the investors have been domestic, and most of those domestic investors have actually been individuals, or relative to our markets, where the majority of investors are institutions, you know, whether pension funds or insurance companies or sort of corporate level investors, mutual funds. In China, it's more individual investors relatively, and that's part of the reason this has been a pretty traumatic break for them.
And do individual investors in China tend to be buying individual equities rather than mutual funds and things that are a little more diversified?
Yes, that's right. They're buying more individual companies based on, you know, sometimes shoddy information and reports from various people, from friends, sometimes based on just the name of the company because it has a lucky name or something. There's a frankly, there isn't a sophisticated approach to stock investment yet in China. That's developing. I mean, again, to be fair, all of this is new. It's only been, as I said, 3 or 4 decades since they even started to grow, and these markets are only 20 years old or so, and some of the recent inflow of money is really new, and so people are learning.
How has the Chinese government tried to maintain control over the value of individual Chinese stocks and over the value of the market as a whole? We'll start there, and then I'll ask a follow-up.
Well, the Chinese government is values an increasing stock market. It's useful to them if the stock market's going up. It makes people happy. It makes them. It makes companies able to raise money more easily. It supports their growth, and so the Chinese government's been kind of talking up market, or it had been until this summer. And in fact, as a result of some of those statements that, the market's only going to go up, including by very senior people in China, the market shot up between the middle of 2014 and about June of 2015. It rose something on the order of 150%. And then, you know, that was clearly overinflated. A lot of these individual companies were trading way, way beyond the sustainable level based on how much money they were making. And, you know, it started to burst. This bubble began to burst. And once, you know, that starts, it's very hard to stop. Unfortunately, the Chinese government tried to stop it. They moved in and tried to tell people they couldn't sell shares, tell institutions they couldn't sell shares. They suspended new listings of companies. They spent a lot of money, and probably are still spending some money, trying to prop up prices. And that was then seen as kind of panic and unhelpful. So that's been part of the challenge here.
Matthew P. Goodman is my guest. He's chair in political economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and former White House coordinator for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. We're talking about China and the global economy. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about China and the global economy with Matthew P. Goodman, who is William E. Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. If you've got a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Matthew, so we have the Chinese government setting up the stock market, giving information about what's going on in the stock market. Have the companies that have done particularly well on the Shanghai exchange been those that have been most favored by the Chinese government?
Well, yes. I mean, there's certainly favored companies in China that the government wants to support. Obviously, the state-owned sector, I mentioned those strategic industries, banks, telecommunications, heavy industry, and so forth. Those have been the favored children, as it were, in the economy. And then some of these big new or growing new private sector companies, Alibaba, Tencent, some of these other companies have been given an ability to more room to operate and take advantage of these improving markets while they were going up. And of course, a lot of these companies have now been hit pretty hard by the declines, which have been, as you said in your intro, very sharp, 30% plus this year.
Do people in China have, say, retirement savings stashed in the stock market in the way that a lot of Americans do?
Not in the same way. This is, again, a relatively new phenomenon, and Chinese have been busy making money. They do save a lot, but not enough for the tidal wave of aging that is going to hit them. Like a lot of Asian economies, and indeed economies around the world, their population is aging very rapidly, and they have an extra problem in China because they have had this one-child policy, which means there aren't as many, which is being eased now, but it still has had an impact in terms of not enough working people to support the growing retired population. And that's part of the reason people are putting away their own money, because they don't think they're going to get money from the government. Some of that money has gone into the stock market, and not on a sort of, again, on a sort of macro basis on the same scale as the U.S., but there are individual people who have been using the stock market to try to build up that nest egg, and they've been, you know, hurt very badly. So it's going to be a problem both, you know, both economically and, frankly, politically, something I think we're going to get onto. But it is having an impact.
What is the thinking behind the adjustments made to the value of the yuan?
Well, China has been trying to move to a more market-determined exchange rate. As you said, the yuan, or sometimes called the renminbi, is their currency, and it was pegged completely to the dollar. It didn't move in the roughly 8 to the dollar range until 2005, when they started a process of loosening that peg to the dollar. And as a result of that, actually, the yuan has actually appreciated. It's gone up in value, and it's kind of got around the level of 6 to the dollar, which means, you know, stronger against the dollar. The pressure recently has been for the yuan to devalue or depreciate, because China is suffering this slower growth, and the higher, stronger yuan has been undercutting their competitiveness. What happened earlier this month was that the government decided to take a step to actually devalue the currency. It was sort of a two-step. They were both moving to make the currency weaker, more competitive, but they were also loosening the trading mechanism in a way that's a little complicated, but basically they allowed the market rate to be determined a little more flexibly. So directionally, that was a good thing in terms of policy, but it did lead to a depreciation or a weakening of the yuan, which is a cause of some concern around the world.
China's central bank has cut interest rates five times since November, most recently this week. It's cut reserve rate requirements for banks. Is that sufficient to stimulate banks lending to businesses in China?
Well, they did do that, as you say, partly in response to this stock market break, although I think, you know, fundamentally more related to the slowing of the overall economy. And they are trying to provide more liquidity, more, you know, monetary stimulus to the economy. They've been trying to do that through various means. You mentioned there have been five rate cuts. Plus, they've been doing some stuff on the fiscal side, you know, spending large amounts of money. They did that in spades back after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. And that's some of the problem that's happening now is we're unwinding from that excessive stimulus spending. They're still doing some of that, but some people think they ought to do more because the economy has slowed quite dramatically. So there is a, you know, there's a worry about that, and the government is trying to address it. Unfortunately, it's not having the same impact that it used to have. Every dollar they spend or, you know, or liberate through monetary easing doesn't seem to be producing the kind of growth result that it used to.
I don't know if it's possible for you to generalize about this, but do most market regulators in China, most banking regulators, do they come to the West to be educated, or are they educated in this country that until not so long ago was running a communist economy?
Right. Well, a lot of them were actually, of course, raised in that system. But as you suggested, a lot of these folks, regulators and policymakers, have been educated in the West, including particularly the United States. And then many of them have gone back. There's even a name for these people, sea turtles. They migrate back to China to help build the new economy. And so they're very technically adept. These are very sophisticated people. I think they shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't look on them as somehow unsophisticated developing country bureaucrats or something. These are pretty polished technocrats. But, you know, this problem, they don't have a lot of experience with managing this kind of an issue, a dramatic slowdown in the economy together with this sort of instability and volatility in a stock market. And that's been challenging. So it's a new world for them.
If government interventions can't forestall further economic crisis in China, could the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party and its leadership be challenged?
Yeah, that is a thing that people are talking about now. I mean, let me just start by saying I don't think there is an immediate risk to stability of, you know, the Communist Party or even of the leadership of the Communist Party right now. I think that's people who are talking in that way are probably over-dramatizing this. But it is true that the legitimacy of the Communist Party has largely rested on two main pillars. One has been delivering economic growth, and that's what they've done for the last 30, 40 years. And the other is nationalism and making China great again, restoring it to the place that it had for 5,000 years, kind of before we showed up and spoiled the party 150 years ago. And so they want to encourage people to think they're the best place to go, the Communist Party, to restore the glory of China. And that is the other pillar. And the thing is, with this economic pillar being weakened by slower growth, by now these financial market problems, there is a risk to the legitimacy of the party that worries, I think, the party leadership and may explain some of the increased nationalism that you see coming out of China, because that's to compensate for, to some extent, that's to compensate for this weakening economic pillar.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bruce in Mansfield. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was wondering if you can comment on what is China's investments in Africa, how does it affect its markets? Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, good question. Yes, China has been investing heavily in the African continent for, you know, the last 10, 15 plus years, largely to in search of those commodities that we were talking about earlier. They're trying to bring in minerals and energy resources and other essential sort of fuel for their dramatic growth. And so they've been heavily investing in the continent. And that has both been a – it's sort of been a mixed blessing, I think, for both China and for Africa. It's helped to produce some development of not only those mineral sectors but and commodity sectors, but the kind of infrastructure and services around that. So it has helped those local economies. It's obviously helped China develop these new sources of commodities. On the other hand, frankly, it has sometimes been controversial. Some of the Chinese investment has been largely Chinese sort of dropping in, you know, with Chinese laborers digging the stuff out of the ground and taking it away. And I think a lot of African countries are, you know, concerned about that. It's not creating the growth and employment opportunities locally that they, you know, were sort of hoping when they invited or welcomed the Chinese in. And the Chinese are beginning to realize that that's a problem for them too. So it's changing. Their posture is changing a bit, but it's been a recurring theme in some of their international investments, including in Africa.
Matthew, with respect to demand for real democracy in China, many people have said as long as, you know, average people see their bank accounts expanding and their lifestyles improving, they're willing to be pretty complacent with the government. Do you think if we see a slowdown or even a reversal in economic growth in China, there could be some more agitating for something that looks like a representative democracy in China?
Well, I don't think we're on the brink of Jeffersonian democracy in China. So again, let me just make that clear. But it is certainly true that you know, in any country, it's sort of logical that as more and more people get a stake in you know, a middle class lifestyle and the expectations grow, if that rug gets pulled out from under you, you know, it can lead to some dissatisfaction and you want to blame someone. And in their system, in our system, if that happened, you'd throw the bums out, right? You'd get a new leadership. You can't do that in China. And so the grumbling certainly, sometimes it manifests itself in actual protest activity. In fact, even the reported numbers of incidents in China across the country on an annual basis are in the, you know, tens of thousands, 70,000, as I recall, a year or two ago. That's the reported numbers from the Chinese authority. There's certainly more than that in reality. So you get some of that. But again, I don't think that that is going to manifest itself in the near term in the kind of democracy that we would recognize. I do think, you know, that one shouldn't underestimate the power of public opinion in China. It does actually affect governance a lot. The leadership does look at what people are saying on social media, you know, what they're saying in these protests, and they are very sensitive to it. But that doesn't mean that they're going to allow, you know, sort of free voting or allowing free expression anytime soon.
How does the Chinese government release information, release economic data to its own people, and how often can that be trusted?
Yeah, well, that is that's another big issue. You know, the society or the system of government is quite opaque and quite closed and quite controlled. And it's only relatively recently that China has started to move its official statistics into a kind of a more transparent and believable pattern. I think that, you know, they've posted these GDP results, which probably, you know, on orders of magnitude are not far off. In other words, you mentioned multiple years of 10% growth, plus or minus, that's probably right. But there are a lot of people who think, for example, right now that when they say they're going to grow about 7% this year, that's quite optimistic and probably somewhat manipulated. The numbers have been manipulated to make it look better than it really is, and that real growth may be lower than that, certainly in the 6% range, maybe even lower. And so, you know, they're trying to get better at that, but it's hard in their system because full transparency kind of reveals other things that they don't want people to know about, and it creates a sense of it could undermine, in their thinking, the confidence in the government's economic management. So they're careful about how they manage data.
In the interest of perspective, it's worth noting that a lot of people in this country would do a backflip for 6% growth in a year.
That's a very good point. It's true that you know, China's, even if they slow by the worst sort of estimates, you know, down to, you know, 4 or 5%, and I'm not predicting that. Don't do my own forecast of Chinese growth, but you see those numbers out there. Even if it were that, that's going to be better than us. Now, I see our second quarter GDP numbers came out today, and they were 3.7%, which is not bad for us. Remember, we're growing from a much bigger base, so, you know, it's harder to generate more growth. And that's, by the way, sort of what's happened to China, that they've gone from a period where they were a small economy. It's easy to grow. It's not easy, but relatively, mathematically, it's easier to grow fast from a very small number. Once you get big, as they are, they're now a $10 trillion economy. It becomes harder to eke out that growth. So against that backdrop, you know, 5-6% growth isn't bad. And so we shouldn't forget that. They are still growing, probably. And, you know, that's something that many analysts have pointed out. It's not like the wheels are coming off and they're in the middle of some kind of economic or financial meltdown.
I'm curious, as an economist, how do international observers take the pulse of the Chinese economy if official numbers from the government or businesses that are supported by the government in part cannot fully be trusted?
Yeah, it's difficult. And again, that hasn't been a professional problem for me. I haven't had to actually do that sort of number analysis. But a lot of my friends and colleagues do that kind of thing. And it's very hard. Some of it is taking the official statistics and trying to compare them over a period of time and discount for some of this inflated optimism, as it were. And some of it's looking at more specific indicators like electricity power generation to see whether that's an indicator, you know, of whether things are really growing as much, because you would expect in a faster growing economy that industrial and consumer use of electricity would grow. So people play games like that and try to calculate this, but it's more an art than a science, and that is a challenge for international observers and investors, you know, who want to know what's actually happening.
Matthew P. Goodman is my guest. He's former White House Coordinator for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, now William E. Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about China and the global economy. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matthew P. Goodman. He's chair in political economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about China and the global economy. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think. Matthew, I want to talk about energy. You mentioned it earlier. There has been great concern in many corners of the world, particularly the United States, that China is a real competitor now for a lot of different forms of energy. Are we seeing that falling off? And is there a limit to which Chinese demand for energy might diminish?
Well, it is a huge consumer of energy, and you know, a $10 trillion economy is going to need a lot of fuel to grow, and so that's going to continue. And you know, but there are limits to that, and you know, both because growth is slowing and because, you know, they can't keep producing a sort of fossil fuel intensive form of growth, which they have, and that's led to a lot of challenges for the government there. You know, environmental pollution is catastrophic right now. You know, particulate matter in the air in Beijing. If you've ever been there, you know it's unbreathable. And so they are trying to both, I mean, they are being forced to consume less energy because they're slowing in growth, or you know, they're buying less new energy, but they're also trying to make it more sustainable, investing in renewables and solar and in wind and other forms of energy, nuclear energy that don't add to the carbon in the environment. And so all of that is both, I think, actually in balance. This is that directional move is good for us because it gives us both an opportunity to work with China to develop sustainable sources of energy, to work on new technologies to help deal with climate change. And there have been some positive signs in that regard. So overall, when you ask me about energy in China, I think, yes, a problem, but one that actually is, if anything, heading in the right direction.
It seems like in some ways China right now is going to have kind of a rocky adolescence as it moves into being a fully developed, maybe, you know, first developed world economy. But all these adjustments that are happening maybe are happening at the right time to put it in place to be, you know, there's an unlatching, I guess, of government support of some of these industries and an effort, it sounds like, to kind of set private businesses on their own to develop into the future. Am I correct about that?
Yeah. I mean, I, in a way, this should have been the first thing we talked about, which is that China is in this historic transformation. You know, they've hit this so-called middle income trap when they have grown to a certain level where, you know, they're sort of, you know, comfortable in some ways as a middle class economy based on this low labor cost, high production investment sort of model. And they've hit this trap that a lot of countries face when to get to that next level, you need to really innovate. You need to become a different kind of economy. And that's what they recognize. I mean, to their credit, as they say, you know, the first step to alcoholic recovery is to acknowledge you have a problem. And they have definitely acknowledged they have a problem. And so what we're seeing here, the big story is that they're moving from this investment export-led model to one that is more based on consumption, on services, on innovation. And that's what they have to do to make this transition. And so they recognize that. They've got a plan for market-based reform to help promote those things. But reform is difficult because there are a lot of vested interests that don't want change, and they're fighting back, and it's becoming a real headache for the authorities. And that's what you're seeing is some of the tussle. A Financial Times columnist the other day called it a push-me-pull-you sort of struggle between the forces of reform and the forces of vested interests that are fighting reform and of the state, frankly, that still they still have this instinct. To me, the fundamental tension and the fundamental problem in China is that the economic logic of what they need to do suggests loosening up and letting go and letting people innovate and discover new products and new technologies. But the political imperative in China is in the other direction. It's consolidating and closing and tightening. And you see a lot of that with Xi Jinping and his consolidation of power, in his anti-corruption campaign, in his restrictions that he's imposed on so-called Western ideas and on the internet and so forth. And I just, you know, to me, there's a fundamental tension and contradiction there. I'm not sure how you get to that next level economically unless you let go politically. Again, I'm not suggesting Jeffersonian democracy, but I do think they have to let go politically. And then that starts raising questions about the legitimacy of the Communist Party as the sole manager of all of these affairs in the eyes of many Chinese.
Is there evidence of fractious relationships among Xi's advisors?
Well, I think that may have been overstated by some. I believe that Xi has, in a way that I think nobody really predicted, at least the speed of this, has consolidated power and has dealt with many of his potential rivals. And I think he has not got the sort of internal challenge that some people think. I don't think there is a hot sort of factionalism within the Communist Party. I think he's the, you know, he's the undisputed leader. But this economic stuff is, I think, raising questions because, you know, he can put people in jail, he can close down the internet. But when it comes to the markets, you know, you can't put people in jail, you can't tell the market what to do at the end of the day. And so it's not as much in his control. And to the extent that starts giving ammunition to people who have other reasons to maybe want to challenge him. That could undermine his position. I don't think that's happening yet. It's certainly not visibly happening. And even behind the scenes, I think that can be overstated. But it is the biggest challenge to him, I think, that he faces is this economic uncertainty.
Many Americans have lamented our trade imbalance with China, which is to say, on the whole, we buy a lot more stuff from them than they buy from us. Does that imbalance, though, act as a sort of safeguard for the U.S. economy if there is anything approaching a recession on the consumer level in China?
Yeah, well, I mean, the trade imbalance, I'm an economist, so I have to say bilateral trade imbalances are not economically significant. I mean, it's, you know, we trade with a lot of people and we don't always, the famous story, you know, when you get a haircut or something, you don't, it isn't there's a trade imbalance when you know, between what you're doing there. And yet, you know, that's fine because in other transactions you're receiving money. And so it doesn't really matter. But certainly as a political matter, the trade imbalance is a big deal and it's large. It's over $300 billion U.S. dollars a year. And certainly there are real concerns about the ability of U.S. companies to export their products into China. In fact, the U.S. business community has been a pillar of support for the U.S.-China relationship, and that's starting to erode both because those export opportunities aren't there. Again, some of that is just because growth is slowing, but some of it's because of restrictions. And then those companies that are investing in China, which they've done on a very large scale, $60, $70 billion of stock of investment there, those companies are starting to feel the heat as well. They're facing theft of their intellectual property. They're facing anti-monopoly enforcement that is widely seen as, you know, unfair and targeted at foreign companies. They're facing a lot of regulatory hurdles. So it's a difficult environment for them. And that's eroding one of the pillars of support in the economy, I'm sorry, in the relationship. And so, you know, I think this, in that sense, the bilateral economic relationship between the U.S. and China is unbalanced, and that causes some problems. I guess you were suggesting there are also some benefits to it, including the fact that China has a lot of money they earn from their, you know, global surpluses that they invest in the U.S. market, and that's been helpful to us as we've had a lot of debt and we've needed to raise money, and China's been a big investor in our treasury bonds. But it's, you know, it's not ideal. A more balanced relationship is something that is important both politically and, you know, and economically.
There have been predictions floated for some time that inevitably China is poised to become the world's largest economy just based on population and based on the growth rates that it's seen, thereby surpassing the United States, which is currently the world's largest economy. Is this cooling period that we're seeing right now likely to delay that? And is that good or bad for the United States? Does it matter whether we are the largest economy in the world?
Well, by one measure, China's already bigger than us by so-called purchasing power parity, basically what a dollar will buy you in China or a yuan will buy you in China. By that standard, they're already bigger than us. By current exchange rates, we're still bigger. We're about 16 trillion U.S. dollars. They're about 10 U.S. dollars, 10 trillion U.S. dollars. So we're significantly bigger on the earlier growth path that they were on and we were on. Most people predicted that within the next decade or two, China was going to overtake us. That may have been slowed a little by this slowing growth. And frankly, you know, the U.S. is doing better than expected. If they overtake us, you know, it's just a number on one level. It's not the be-all and end-all. We're still going to be a big, powerful, important country. The other thing is that on a per capita basis, because China has $1.3 billion, even if they surpass our $16 trillion, when you divide that by $1.3 billion, that's going to be a much smaller number than, you know, our per capita income with 300 million people. So we're still going to be a richer country by that standard for quite a long time, probably through much of the rest of this century, unless something dramatic changes. So we're going to still be an important country, even if we're statistically number two.
How are China's Asia neighbors likely to be affected by its current challenges?
Well, that's a big problem because China is the the top trading partner for now probably about 120, 130 countries in the world, and certainly all of its immediate neighbors in Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea, Australia, all these countries are very dependent on their economic relationship with China. So as China slows down, that's a real problem for them in terms of their ability to export and increase that economic pie. It also has some other indirect effects, China's challenges, because, as I mentioned before, there's a bit of a trade-off. It's a little oversimplified, but to the extent their economy is slowing down, and that's eroding one of the pillars of legitimacy, you know, the Chinese have become somewhat more nationalistic, and they're pushing out more. For 30 years under that aforementioned leader I mentioned earlier, Deng Xiaoping, they had a foreign policy strategy of hiding their strength and biding their time, the so-called hide and bide strategy. Well, Xi Jinping, the new leader, has torn that up and is pushing out, both in a security sense. You know, they're building these islands on reefs and underwater rocks with sand. And we actually at CSIS have an online site that you can look at, the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, that has terrific photographs of this stuff. And you can see that they're going to build runways and things. And that's causing a lot of concern in Vietnam and the Philippines and Malaysia and other countries in that periphery of China. Similar problems in the space between China and Japan. And then on the economic side, China has launched this huge package of initiatives broadly called the One Belt, One Road Initiative, which is basically investments in infrastructure, you know, roads and railroads and telecommunications connections across the Eurasian landmass and the maritime south of China. And that is both a good thing because it's creating new development and opportunity for those countries, but it's also quite assertive, and some of the neighbors are a little worried about the implications of all this. You know, it's going to displace people, it's going to create environmental problems, it's going to make them subject to more Chinese influence. So there's a lot of anxiety in the neighborhood, but they need China economically. So probably their biggest anxiety is that China is going to dramatically slow down and they're not going to have those opportunities.
You've been in many discussions within the White House about China and its economy. What do you think is on the agenda these days?
Well, I think, again, some of the things we've been talking about, I do think that the concern about China slowing down is probably the top agenda item on the economic side, because a slowdown, a dramatic slowdown or break would be really problematic for us, because we need China to grow and provide demand to the world. I do think there are a range of other issues, and President Xi Jinping of China is going to be coming to Washington next month, and he'll be meeting with President Obama. And my guess is, in addition to these economic issues, which will be definitely front and center, they're going to talk about that island building in the South China Sea. They're going to talk about cybersecurity, because there's been a big concern about China stealing U.S. companies' trade secrets. And they're going to talk about human rights and other issues.
Matthew P. Goodman is chair in political economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and former White House coordinator for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. You can read his work at csis.org. Matthew, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalmankin. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.